Well, good morning. There's a well-known phrase or expression relating to the great American film director, which is "Ready when you are, Mr. DeMille," which is of rather unknown provenance. No one's quite sure where it originally came from. At least that's what Charlton Heston claims in his autobiography, In the Arena. He has a rather long anecdote, which he says is not the source, but which I thought I would try to entertain you with this morning. So, Charlton Heston was Moses in the Ten Commandments, and they were filming one of the early scenes, and DeMille liked to do things on an absolutely massive and grand scale. And they were going to be filming this sort of caravan sequence of the exodus of the Israelites leaving Egypt, and he had got together 8,000 people and 5,000 head of livestock, and they were going to film this great big long exodus scene. And they had three cameras set up, and the director shouts, "Action," and all the animals and the people duly roll past, and it takes quite some time. And presumably Charlton Heston's in the foreground as Moses looking over them all. And the scene finishes, and the director turns to his assistant and says, "Oh, that looks pretty good." He calls over to the first camera unit, the one that's in the foreground, the close shot, and says, how did that look, Fred?" And Fred shouts back, "Sorry, Mr. DeMille, the tape broke after 50 foot." Now, I should probably just say, for those of you who are under probably about 20, cameras used to actually have film in them, and this is kind of like fragile, light-sensitive material that breaks quite easily. So they only shot 50 foot of tape, which was probably only about 30 seconds. He goes, "Oh, well, never mind. We can do the close-up easily again. That's no problem." He gets his megaphone out and he shouts to the people, the camera crew in the middle distance, the kind of wide-angle view, "How did that look, guys?" And they shout back, "Sorry, Mr. DeMille. One of the wheels came off one of the ox carts right in front of our position just as everything started. Our view was completely blocked. We didn't get anything." He goes, "Oh, well, never mind. That's not too bad. At least we still got the long view." So he picks up the telephone. And again, for those of you who are probably under the age of about 20, telephones used to be connected by wires. And in this particular position, the distant camera crew is about a quarter of a mile away. So they've just got a telephone with a wire going straight down to the end. So he picks the telephone up and says to the guys at the other end, "How did that look?" And of course, you know what they said. "Ready when you are, Mr. DeMille." Now, Charlton Heston says that's not actually how that phrase came about. And you might also be wondering how this is relevant to our passage this morning. Well, it's the middle of the summer, and there's not many of you here, and I thought you might indulge me because I thought it was the best chance I was going to get to use that in a biblical passage. Although it does link quite well with the stories of Jacob and Joseph onto what we will then get is the next major story, which follows on directly in Exodus with Moses. And perhaps if you'll like, you'll let me use it as a metaphor for having a different perspective on the same events. So if you like, this morning we're looking at the close-up view is the reunion of Joseph with his brothers. The kind of middle distance picture is like the story of Joseph within Genesis itself, following on from Jacob. And if you like, the wider view, the long distance view, is actually the history of God's people, the foundation of Israel. Well, DeMille liked Bible stories for a number of reasons. One of the first ones was there was no copyright, so that saved money. Everybody involved in them was dead, so there was no chance of being sued, which is obviously quite important in Hollywood. There was quite a lot of wide artistic license, and if you've seen any of his films, you'll realise that he has been fairly free with the material. But primarily, I think he liked them because they were such great stories. They would rival any modern soap opera. So let's just remind ourselves of where we've come with Joseph's story so far. We have this ageing patriarch, Jacob, who has not one, but two wives, and also two concubines. He's got 10 unruly sons, and one younger son who he favours and turns into something of a spoilt brat, which is Joseph. Naturally, his brothers hate him. They sell him into slavery. They lie to their father about what they've done. Even so, Joseph prospers in prison. until an older woman attempts to seduce him. Then he's wrongfully in prison. He languishes in prison until his interpretation for dreams is required, and then he's rapidly promoted to become Egypt's prime minister. We've also got a famine, a couple of journeys to foreign lands, as Miranda was talking this morning, more trumped-up charges of espionage, theft, kidnapping, and more false imprisonment. It's a bit like Dallas without the oil, or Dynasty without the shoulder pads. Although, again, if you're under about 40, you probably wouldn't recognise that. And along the way, we've also had, in the backstory, prostitution, arbitrary executions, an ongoing international disaster, and Soviet-style collective agriculture. And we haven't even got to the end of Genesis yet. You couldn't make it up. And actually, I think DeMille did say that. If you came to him with a script for this to Hollywood, you'd be thrown out of Tinseltown. It sounds unbelievable. And just as an aside, quite often one hears, people will say that the Bible has been sanitised or harmonised in some way, and that all the awkward and difficult stuff has been taken out of it. And you have to wonder, really, whether they're reading the same book, whether they've actually read any of this. The fact that it appeals to a Hollywood director like DeMille should convince critics that it's hardly sanitised. Okay, so perhaps that's the appeal, but what can we learn from this rather dysfunctional family and from Joseph's story? And we do need to take some care not to overinterpret or to read too much into Joseph's life story, into our own life story, because of perhaps those three different views I've given you at the start. So, for example, I could say, and perhaps somebody might, that this passage was all about grown men crying and being in touch with their emotions. You know, you could say that this actually the Bible was well ahead of its time and it's very Western and 21st century. Actually, I think what we read here is much more to do with Middle Eastern 21st century BC culture than our current one. And in fact, what the passage is all about, in fact, the whole of Joseph's story is all about, Joseph says himself in verses 5, 7 and 8, and Miranda's already read those, but let's just have a quick look at them again. He says to his brothers, "Do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." And he repeats that essentially in verses 7 and 8. So a very clear message there from Genesis, from Joseph's own words, that it's actually God's plan. And that's the main message from the whole of Joseph's story. And it's actually for God's people, a point that Daniel made in his message a couple of weeks ago. Now, it's unlikely that we can expect the kind of turbulent events that Joseph has gone through to be directly relevant to us. In fact, I think the only person who has anything like a comparable experience is probably Nick Clegg, who's probably the only person since Joseph's time who's found himself welcomed by other brothers and then promoted to a position of prime ministerial responsibility in no time at all. However, we can learn from the behaviour of people in this passage. As Daniel said a couple of weeks ago, there's often two ways to respond. Daniel was talking about opposition and submission. In this case, I'm going to suggest there are other ways, positive or negative ways, of responding to things. And we can learn from the characters in this about how they do that. So this morning, I'm going to give you three R's, which, unlike the ones at school, do actually all start with R. So the first one, recognition. It's understandable, isn't it, that Joseph's brothers don't recognise him. They've been separated from him for 20 years, and they don't recognise him physically because he's dressed like an Egyptian prince. And in fact, we learn from the previous chapters that he's also been speaking through an interpreter. He can understand them, but they can't understand him. And he has to reassure them three times in this passage that it's actually him that they're standing on. And of course, they're afraid of him as well. So it takes them a while to accept him, which they don't do until verse 15. By which time, of course, there's been so much crying that even the Egyptians have realised that Joseph has got some significant visitors. And this is also why we read that Joseph, when he does send his brothers off, sends them off with a huge number of goods and wagons and carts. And this is to convince their father Jacob that he is really alive. And again, just as an aside, perhaps important little detail, you'll see that the editor here actually changes from using Jacob's name back to his faith name. So if you look down to verses 27 and 28, it says, "The spirit of their father Jacob revived, and Israel said, 'I am convinced.'" And I wonder actually whether they didn't recognise Jacob because they weren't expecting to. In the same way, perhaps, that the disciples on the road to Emmaus didn't recognise Jesus because with their rational, their logical minds, perhaps even with their own eyes, they knew Jesus had died. Perhaps the disciples were also slow to believe the women's news about the empty tomb in the garden for the same reason, and of course for their fear as well, which also tends to stop belief. Interestingly, Mary Magdalene, I think, it's difficult to say whether she had more faith, but she was probably more trusting and more open. She only had a short conversation with Jesus, and he only had to say her name, perhaps in a characteristic way, and she recognised him much more quickly. So let's recognise God's hand in our lives. If God is our Heavenly Father, then, and we are his sons and daughters, then we should be looking, we should be expectant, should be recognising those things. Let's not limit God by recognising or not recognising what he's capable of doing by limiting ourselves in that sense. So, recognition. But we've also got here reconciliation. Now, I understand we didn't actually look at the passage that was kind of set last week, which was chapters 42 to 44, but I'm hoping that most people are reasonably familiar with that, and Miranda has touched upon that. In that sequence, Joseph tests his brothers, basically to determine what their change of heart has been over those 20 years. Are they really sorry for what they had done for him? Bearing in mind, of course, they don't know that he's speaking to them. And in fact, the three eldest sons all offer themselves, or in fact their children, as an insurance for Benjamin. Joseph is keen to get the whole family, including his father and his younger brother, who's also, if you like, the other love child, as Neil put it, the other brother of his beloved wife, Rachel, who's Joseph's immediate kin, if you like. He's keen to get them all to come. And Jacob is very unkeen to let Benjamin go into Egypt, probably because he doesn't trust the brothers. And there's an indication in verse 4 of chapter 42 that he was uncertain that they would look after him if he let him go. And so the three oldest brothers actually offer themselves as an insurance to Jacob to say, don't keep him. So when Joseph arranges for Benjamin to leave, when they leave, he has his silver cup placed in this kind of knapsack, and Benjamin is accused of stealing the silver cup. And Judah responds, when they all go back and protest to him, Judah says, "What can we say to you, my lord, Joseph, this is, how can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We are now your lord's slaves." Judah knows that they haven't stolen the cup, maybe Benjamin has, they don't know that. But he confesses their guilt on behalf of all of them for what they did previously to Joseph, in fact. He says, "God has uncovered your servant's guilt." So they offer themselves as slaves for Benjamin. Don't take the young lad, it will break our father's heart. Take us instead. You've almost got no better picture in the Bible of sin leading to actual slavery or imprisonment. So the brothers' original sin of against Joseph is now going to put them in real danger of slavery and imprisonment. And you've also perhaps got no better picture of one person trying to ransom their life for another. But Joseph is forgiving. He's got quite a generous and trusting nature, I think, in many senses, as he says in verses 5 and 7. We've already looked at that. And he doesn't just recognise God's hand in this. This is true forgiveness. So if you look down to verses 10 and 11, he says, "You will live near me, and I will provide for you." And in verse 15, then he kisses his brothers and wept over them all. So this is true forgiveness and reconciliation. There's no kind of grudging half measures in this. And surely this should be the mark of the Christian. It would be only too human if Joseph had wanted to punish his brothers a bit longer or in some other ways. And some critical commentators have suggested that's what he does in chapters 42 to 44. But in that particular case, the trial really was necessary to put his brothers through that, and also his father as well. In fact, Simeon is left behind for a couple of years in Egypt, and Jacob is very reluctant to let Benjamin go into Egypt when they need more food. But that trial is necessary to restore all the relationships. And by doing that, by going through that trial, and you can see that's really a sermon and a message in its own right anyway, isn't it? By going through that trial, they get to a better end result. I seem to have had quite a few recent conversations with Christians, particularly colleagues at work, in the last 2 or 3 months. It's been a few long car journeys when they sort of chatted about other things, and quite a few people do seem to have folk in their family who have cut themselves off from other family members. And it particularly seems to be brothers, but not exclusively so. So broken relationships do seem to be sadly all too common, and obviously that is very difficult in those particular cases. And it's easy for me to say this. Obviously, we should forgive those who have injured us, and I can say that easily because I don't really feel I've got any of those kind of circumstances, but lots of other people do, and it's very painful. And of course, there's also responsibility, if you cause the injury, to actually accept the forgiveness which is on offer, which Joseph's brothers certainly do in this case. So we need to offer forgiveness, and we should also accept forgiveness with an open hand as well, if that's on offer. But there may also be a role, perhaps, for mediation. One of my colleagues at one of our other sites used to work where I was. I know he's going through a very difficult time with his wife at the moment, and I had calls to phone him during the week, and I did just ask about how things were going with that, and I think actually he was quite touched, not being a Christian, just to be asked about that by somebody other than his line manager. Now, I can't mediate in that relationship. I don't know them that well or anything, but just even that kind of care, I think, said something to him in that case. Joseph's attitude, I think, is summed up very well by Paul, actually, in Romans, not referring to Joseph, but if you look at Romans 12, verses 17 through to 19, Paul says in one of his summaries, actually about love, "Do not repay anyone evil for evil." Joseph certainly hasn't done that. "Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody." And Joseph was very keen to. So, for example, he could have been easily tempted to give in to the advances of Potiphar's wife when his situation looked hopeless and maybe there was no other opportunity, but he didn't do that. And then Paul says, "If it is possible, as far as it depends upon you, live at peace with everybody. And do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath." Joseph does ignores all of those kind of failings, things that Paul speaks against, and in doing so rescues his brothers from their crimes. Okay, so the last point, it's not just about reconciliation, it's about wholehearted restoration. And this is not just about, well, not just only about, say, physical reformation of the family. They're all going to be together again in Egypt. And it's not just about physical reward. In fact, Joseph says in verse 20 of this chapter we're looking at, "Never mind about all of your belongings and all the rest of it, because the best of all Egypt will be yours." And in fact, they're going to be settled in the land of Goshen, a land put apart for them. Incidentally, a place where there were few Egyptians living, ideal for pasture and for sheep farming and such like, which they did. And also this would protect them from kind of intermarriage and the influence of foreign culture, which was such a problem for them both before and after being in Canaan. I should also just pick up on a point. This is quite important as well, and again it came from Miranda's reading, which was very helpful. They're going to leave the promised land temporarily, and Jacob really needs an assurance from God that that's the right thing to do, which is given to him in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 46, to prove that that is the right decision, because otherwise he appears to be going against what God has promised him in terms of inheriting and staying in the promised land. So this is actually where, in Egypt, Israel's family is going to turn into Israel's nation, the nation of Israel. And notice too, again just as an aside, that's a temporary residence as guests. And that makes much more sense of what then happens in Exodus when Pharaoh refuses to let my people go, as Moses says. Because actually they were there as guests and they were there, ideally, temporarily. Okay, well let's get back to the restoration. So Joseph has basically restored all the relationships. By restoring the relationships with his brothers can't go back and tell their father, Jacob, the good news that Joseph is alive without confessing to their own guilt and action in the matter. Because they've actively deceived him. They've also brought his coat along, torn up, covered in blood. And as I said, there were signs that Jacob didn't entirely trust them anyway. And that's probably why Joseph says, And it also seems like a bit of an aside in verse 24. Then he said to his brothers as they were leaving, don't quarrel along the way. But again, that's quite a natural response. It could be quite easily some recriminations amongst them. So they're going back, what are we going to tell Dad? You know, actually, you wanted to throw him in the pit. You wanted to sell him into slavery. You wanted to murder him. Could easily have got quite unpleasant. So, but presumably they have actually learnt from that. There's also an interesting parallel, I think, actually, with some of this, with the parable of the prodigal son, which I won't dwell upon. In that parable, of course, one son strays. In this case, the son is lost. That's Joseph. One father watches expectantly. Jacob doesn't, perhaps because he doesn't expect to see Joseph again. The joy on being reunited, of course, is the same. And what a great picture you have of a father, both in the parable but also in this passage as well, of a father receiving his son back from the dead. Of course, the main context of the parable is actually on the unreconciled older brother, the Pharisees, that Jesus is actually speaking to. Joseph's brothers don't make that mistake in this particular case. So he repairs the relationship with themselves first, and then also with their father, Jacob, as well. And perhaps that's an example of how, as one relationship is corrected, as one relationship gets closer to God, then all do. If one person moves closer to God, then actually everybody else becomes closer to God as well. You get closer fellowship, deeper relationships, stronger sense of community, an incentive, if it was needed, to make sure to restore peace fully. Well, I focused mainly on chapter 45 and the family reunion aspects, because that was actually the title. There's lots of other fascinating, I think, historical details untouched upon. You'll be pleased to know I've left the genealogy from chapter 46 out of that, but there is actually interesting stuff you can get out of genealogies too. I think that may well tie in better with the passage next week, actually. But if there are any questions on some of the other stuff in chapters 47, for example, feel free to ask. I might have read something that was useful around that. But I've tried to focus upon things that we can actually apply to our own lives without over-interpreting the special events of Jacob's life. So if we recognise our status before God, if we look perhaps more for the unexpected, maybe even the miraculous, perhaps we'll actually see a bit more of the miraculous and the unexpected. Obviously, we should work to reconcile, to be reconciled amongst one another, but also perhaps there's a case for mediation and to help others also put their relationships right, and to really work for true restoration, which may not be physical or material in this world, although we should work for that as well, but truly to restore relationships, or perhaps, as we've sung in the words of Psalm 23, to have our souls restored.